Hello and welcome to Bah Humbug, a podcast about the cuddliest of all movie genres, the Christmas movie. My name is Helen O'Hara and I'll be your ho-ho host, for this Christmas season. Start as you mean to go on. Today, of course, we are going to be talking about Debbie Allen's Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square, new this year on Netflix, and we're going to be doing so in contrast to the 1947 classic It's a Wonderful Life from Frank Capra. Will this new contender soon be joining the ranks of Christmas classics, or will it be swept away like last year's wrapping paper? Well, with me to talk about it are two of the world's greatest Christmas movie experts, women who can tell the contents of a cracker at 50 paces and accurately gauge a person's favourite Christmas carol just by looking at them. So first, I'm delighted to welcome broadcaster and journalist Kat Brown, a writer for, Empire, The Telegraph, The Times, Stylist, you name it, and owner of the world's orneriest cats. Hello, Kat.
Hello, I've been singing Oh Holy Night for approximately 3 weeks in preparation. I've learned nothing from it, but I've had a lovely time.
They do say Oh Holy Night in this film, so that's very, very apposite. I think that works. And with us is another one of my favourite people, Kathy Cullen from the Great Cine Mile podcast, which, if you haven't heard it, is the best walk home from a cinema ever. Hi, Kathy, how are you doing?
Hello, I'm good. How are you?
Not too bad, thank you. All the better, of course, for being here to talk about these two films. But before we begin, let's get your sort of calibration on Christmas movies. What is your attitude to Christmas movies in general? Are you an elf or more of a Grinch?
Well, Helen, I have already launched into the festive season by watching my Christmas film, which is the Queen Latifah, LL Cool J vehicle, yes. Last Holiday. I don't think I saw this film until a few years ago. And my life has just been so much the richer since, you know, a wrong forecast of terminal illness, a sensible, slightly downtrodden woman throwing in her awful career and her premium bonds and everything and going to a random giant hotel with a kitchen run by Gérard Depardieu to basically swan around in gowns for the last 3 weeks of her life. Except, obviously, she was never dying and everything ends very happily. What a Christmas miracle!
It's so good. I love that movie as well. It's so, so good. That is the Grand Hotel Pup, actually, where they also filmed Casino Royale. So, Queen Latifah knows.
Is it an actual hotel?
Mm-hmm. Same hotel.
They called it Poop.
I assume it means something really like stylish in, I think, Hungarian. I don't know.
God.
But yeah, we should go when we're rich, yes, which may be a while.
Imminently, I'm sure.
Imminent, any minute now. We could win that lottery rollover. Who knows? Kathy, how about you? Are you a Christmas movies person?
I am. I love Christmas movies. I tend to wait until the 1st of December. This year I have broken that by watching Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square, which I was very pleased to do because it's been a tough year and Christmas needs to come early. But I love Christmas movies. I don't tend to watch them all month. I'll pick a couple and then I'll cycle through every couple of years. So I will never watch the same Christmas movie like back to back year to year. But I need to watch this movie you speak of because I have never seen or heard of it.
Oh my God, you'll love it. It's so good.
So much food, so many frocks,
so much
base jumping.
Yeah, also that. There's not enough base jumping in many Christmas
movies.
Most festive
of sports, exactly.
And are there any unique Christmas traditions in your houses that we should know about? Like, I don't know if there's a normal, but what's tradition in your house? Like, for a few years in my house, it's been traditional to watch Tucker and Dale versus Evil, which is a horror comedy that just makes my mum laugh like you've never heard. So, you know, it's an odd Christmas tradition, but it works for us. How about you guys? Any foods that you've got to have? Any elements to your Christmas that have to be there?
So a few years ago at a farmer's market in Oval, which is the most middle class sentence I'll probably say today, I found this amazing company called the Pished Fish, who basically make really gorgeous booze-infused smoked salmon, which again is a sentence I literally need three runs up to say. So whatever I'm eating, I will always try and get some of that in, along with whatever teeny tiny little mince pies I find in London's finest supermarkets. Ooh. And then basically just exist on a diet of lovely, probably quite expensive fish and tiny mince pies until either Christmas comes or I die of rickets, whichever comes first.
I mean, what a way to go, though.
My mom, who's a regular guest on our podcast, a couple of years ago took a while off work and went on this like retreat to Mexico for months. And
wow.
She like stayed in an ashram and like volunteer there. She was like cleaning the pools. She was like the bellboy for this ashram, and she got to stay there for free. And as part of that, she stayed there for Christmas and had this big like Mexican food Christmas. And ever since, in our family, when we're together, you know, around Christmas Eve, we'll do like a Mexican night, which is quite funny. Amazing. For a load of Irish people. So we do Mexican night with my mom. And yeah, mainly then it involves like, we don't eat meat. So right. We like annoy whoever we're staying with for Christmas because they'll have to like make us a nut roast. And watching the Late Late Toy Show, I would have said, except it was on last night and I didn't bother.
It was on last night. Yeah. So spoiler, we're recording this on the 28th. The Late Late Toy Show is an Irish tradition. It is an absolute mainstay. Happens about a month before Christmas. It's always about this time of year, isn't it? And basically, one of the late night chat shows is taken over by children who explain how all the toys work to adults, essentially, right? Mm-hmm. And every so often, the host will announce that there's one for each and every member of the audience, and it's amazing. Mm-hmm. I was wildly jealous that I never got to go on it as a kid. Like, I watched every year, and I would have been like, oh my God, can you imagine?
Like, well, free toys for a year. But no, I haven't watched it this year yet, but we'll watch it, I think, today with our kid, which would be quite fun. Except I don't want him to want any of the toys.
Yeah, look, we're going to watch them. This, son, and that doesn't mean you're getting them. Yeah. None of them. Right, so, I mean, we've got to actually get into these films because I feel like there's a lot to talk about. So first of all, for anyone who hasn't seen it, well, maybe avoid spoilers for a few minutes, but really, you're probably best off going and watching these films and then coming back, because we will talk about stuff that happens in the plot to the extent that that matters. Christmas on the Square, for those who have yet to have the pleasure, is the story of a businesswoman, Regina Fuller, who's played by the great Christine Baranski, who comes home to her small town just before Christmas to evict everyone, Boo. Raise it to the ground, and build a mall in its place. This meets, understandably, with some opposition, not least from her guardian angel, who is called Angel, and who is played by Dolly Parton. And the big question is, will Regina learn the meaning of Christmas and come to her senses? I have decided to compare and contrast this with It's a Wonderful Life from 1947 for reasons that will become very, very clear as we talk. But It's a Wonderful Life is, of course, the life story of George Bailey, who's played by Jimmy Stewart, the Christine Baranski of his day. And we see his entire life story as he basically gives up on his own dreams one by one and forms a life in town that he's content with most of the time, until something goes horribly wrong and he faces utter ruin and he considers throwing it all away. And so an angel called Clarence comes down from above to convince him that life is worth living by showing him the nightmare scenario of what would happen if he had never lived. So basically, my reasoning was angels. That was pretty much where I was coming from with this. And I did go back and forth because there are other Christmas movies, of course, with angels. And I know that, Kat, you're a big, big fan of one of them, The Bishop's Wife, which is a fantastic movie as well.
Amen.
But this one literally references It's a Wonderful Life twice in dialogue or lyrics. And so I was like, well, I'm sorry, it's going to have to be It's a Wonderful Life. Like, there's no argument there. So let's start with Christmas on the Square. What did you think? It's a lot, this film.
It is a lot.
It's a lot, and yet it's somehow not very much at all, which I found deeply strange. I haven't been this excited about a film since the last time I got wildly excited about a Christmas film, which, to be fair, was probably yesterday. There's a really good crop of new films this year, and it's a bit of a treat. I watched this in a sort of very lockdown way, which was basically having a phone call running with one of my Dolly Parton loving mates at the same time as watching it. And we got very, very excited because obviously it's directed by Debbie Allen of fame and Grey's Anatomy fame. She's directed, she's starred in Grey's Anatomy. She's a strong director. Not that you would know this necessarily from Christmas on the Square. And simultaneously, I ended up looking through the IMDb listing to see who was involved. Yes, Dolly Parton inevitably has her own costume designer, but the costume designer for everybody else has also worked on Girls Trip and has some really good credits. The costumes here are really amazingly, distractingly awful. And it sounds weird that I'm sort of going in first with like a mention of the costumes, but it's because this entire film, it sort of feels as though the names of the people in charge are there, but maybe nobody actually turned up to, e.g., be the producer or be the director, and that they just left it to some people who are perhaps I don't know, colorblind, incapable of dealing with textiles. Maybe the only costumes were available from like the world's worst charity shop. And it completely bewildering. But there's a lot of plaid, there's a lot of things that don't match. And I had an absolutely amazing time watching it. But it is utterly bewildering. And I'm very interested to see what Kathy has to say about it.
Well, I like really got myself in the mood in terms of like made mince pies, like made a hot whiskey, like the whole thing, sat down really excited, expecting it to be bad because I'd seen the trailer and I was so excited for the trailer. I first saw it on Helen's Twitter feed actually, and it made my night when I saw that trailer. But it was what I expected it to be, in that it is naff and it's cheesy. What surprised me was, as you've referenced, the poor production values. I was surprised. I'm just getting the negatives out of the way first because I have a lot of positives. I was surprised at the quality of the music. I expected a lot more from Dolly, have to say. But putting all that aside, because I just decided to go on the journey, I had so much fun with it. I felt like very happy watching it, which, as we know, is a rare feeling in 2020. But I kept thinking, am I enjoying this? Or am I laughing at this? And then I kept, I'm enjoying it. I'm along for the ride. And it ended up touching on some deeper elements that I wasn't expecting with Christine Baranski. She's wonderful. I loved her and Dolly. But like, it is a bit, you know, it is a bit like Scrooged. It is a bit like it's derivative of a lot of things. But I really enjoyed it, and I actually think it had some important things to say, albeit wrapped up in this weird, cheap soundstage bubble. Like, Netflix have a lot of money. Netflix have too much money to warrant a production of this low level, and that's what surprised me, the production levels.
Yeah, there's a lot of snow in this film, and I don't understand why Christian, the amazingly named pastor, but why his wife, who is, you know, trying to get pregnant, is stuck in those incredibly impractical stiletto-heeled pumps, which does not feel warm or safe in this kind of wintry environment.
I read up on her for some reason. I don't know why, but I was convinced I'd seen her in something before, and I was trying to figure out where it was. And she is apparently a debutante. She was a big Southern debutante. She turned down a chance to go to the International Debutante Ball, which is a thing apparently, in order to go and study at like RADA or somewhere, and says her granny still hasn't forgiven her. So maybe like she is the kind of, you know, Elle Woods in Legally Blonde kind of person who just wears stilettos because, you know, that's the only kind of shoe she has. I mean, that's the only explanation I can come up with. You know, there's got to be something. It makes no sense. None of it makes sense.
No. And it's interesting you say that, actually, that she went to RADA or equivalent, because not to be too snarky, but the quality of acting in this movie is questionable. Aside from Christine Baranski and Dolly's like apprentice angel, who is in Grey's Anatomy. Some of the acting is very questionable. It's soap opera-y. So, yeah, I'm surprised to hear that.
Yeah, I think some of it is really just mystifyingly bad. Like, you know, again, I looked up Pastor Christian, and the actor has a career, so he must be capable of good work. He didn't necessarily showcase his very best abilities in this film, but it must exist, right? I don't know.
I think the only person that really comes out of this with any degree of dignity at all is Jennifer Lewis, who basically, I think, just decides to completely ignore the film that everybody else has decided that they're in, completely refuse to wear any of the costumes or the makeup, none of which is suited to the colouring or style of any of the people here, and just basically sing incredibly. Did we know Jennifer Lewis could sing? The pipes on that woman. She's good grief. Yeah. She outthinks Dolly. Yeah, so she, I think, is the only one who gets away with it. Even arguably Christine Baranski, who I adore and was really hoping for a bit more of her old 90s Sybil, Dr. Dick sort of evil style here. But I was completely distracted by the sheer awfulness of her wig, which randomly gains sentience and highlights and different cuts throughout the film, with or without a visit to Jennifer Lewis's hairdresser.
I never noticed her wig. Never noticed it.
Once you notice it, you can never unsee it.
But did you think with Dr. Christian that, or not Dr. Christian, Pastor Christian, sorry. He was like a villain from a soap opera, the way he spoke. He's like, I am the pastor. Mm. And it was really ominous. And agree, yeah, Helen, so... I also IMDb'd him thinking he must be from like Days of Our Lives or something.
Yeah.
No, he's from Legitimate Things.
Yeah, he's a legitimate actor. I thought, you know, maybe he was hired for dancing ability or something like that. And, you know, he was kind of maybe more Broadway style, but no, he's done actual movie work as well.
He's an example of the sheer importance, and I've joked about this before, but seriously, the importance of good makeup and good costume for getting people in character, because Pastor Christian sports a tan, the like of which I have not seen on screen since I used to watch El Dorado on Channel 5. And he's also in this sort of awful zipped up crew top ensemble that you literally only see on the back pages of those little catalogues you get in the slightly elderly leaning newspapers.
Old lady newspapers, absolutely, yeah.
But did you think his goatee was like a direct reference to his slightly villainous father when we heard who the father was?
That's it. I think it must be hereditary. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to get into spoilers now because I have to talk about that scene because, oh my God. So, I mean, this is a film where the dialogue is extremely on the nose. I mean, Jennifer Lewis at one point says to Christine Baranski something along the lines of, even though we're friends who have grown up together. Who says that? Kat, even though we're friends who have known each other since you came to Empire 12 years ago or whatever it was. Like, that's not a thing that people say in casual conversation to one another.
To be honest, even the first time that I saw you after months of not seeing you in the flesh in lockdown, I didn't go, thank God, it's Helen O'Hara, great friend of mine, bridesmaid at my wedding. Thank God, and sort of wave around trees and everything. But I mean, that said, the idea that anybody would go and cut Christine Baranski's god-awful wig when she's just announced that she's making everybody pack up their homes at Christmas because she's flogging it to become Cheat 'em All, which actually is a pun that took me 45 minutes to actually get, being chronically slow on the uptake. But yeah, no, not happening at all. No,
doesn't make any sense. By the way, Jennifer Lewis's character name, we should mention, is Marjolaine. Marjolaine.
Wonderful.
Marjolaine. I can't stop saying it.
I've watched a lot of Southern films because Southern films about generation of women are one of my absolute favourite comfort genres. Never come across Marjolaine. Not even in Southern books.
I mean, can you imagine growing up with that name?
Oh. And growing up with your supposed best friend who is then going to evict you on Christmas Eve from both your business and your home. And you'll still go and cut her hair. Like, I found the whole dynamic very odd. I like that she went to try and sort Christine Baranski out and say, listen, you shouldn't be evicting everyone. Your wig's awful. I'm going to try and fix it. And then she left and didn't fix the hair. But it just rang so hollow. Like I feel like, not to talk too much about A Christmas Carol, because that's not what we're comparing it to, but in A Christmas Carol, like, I really believe that Scrooge is that awful. In this movie, it didn't make sense to me at any point that Christine Baranski was evicting her best friend from her business, who's also, I believe, the town mayor from her town. It rang untrue, and I felt like they should have done a bit of heavier lifting at the beginning of the movie to make Christine Baranski feel a bit more evil, because really she's just someone who's pissed off at her dad and has daddy issues.
And she does say, oh, well, I'm giving you all a good deal, you know, you're getting, you know, she there's an attempt to make her feel like she's doing something right by everybody, but like, it's so half-hearted and so buried and doesn't account for the fact that she's still evicting them on Christmas Eve. Come on.
24 hours notice. Like, that's not
cool, guys.
I'm Sam Clements, host of the 90 Minutes or Less Film Festival, another podcast in the Stripped Media family, a podcast that celebrates movies under 90 minutes long. Each episode, I'm joined by a special guest who selects a movie to join our prestigious lineup. Past guests have come from the worlds of film, television, music, food, comedy, and podcasting. Search for us now on the app you're currently listening to this podcast, or join us at 90minfilmfest.com.
I do want to talk about I don't know if we can call it a twist, but the revelation in the film that the reason that Christine Baranski is so Scroogey is because she was going out with young Treat Williams and they were all loved up, but she wasn't allowed to go to dances until she finally was. And then she sees him with another girl with a ring. And instead of asking him, her boyfriend who she's in love with, hey, what's up with that? She immediately goes off and dances with a guy who I think is meant to be sexy and who I find terrifying. And then yada, 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 Seinfeld style, they have sex, she gets pregnant, and then she is basically hidden away from the world until she can have the baby, give it up for adoption. And spoiler, the baby turns out to be Pastor Christian. And the reason she knows this is because her dad writes his name in the family Bible, and it's written in a Bible, so it must be true. Which is a lovely thought. But
this all sort of also ties into her dad's obsession with lamplighting, which is such a weird Victorian thing. There's no sort of mention of her mum or literally any other family members, because apparently they aren't required. And we'll get onto the script writing a little bit later, because there's lots to say about that. But it's the fact that her dad is supposed to be like a really good guy, and yet he obviously never teaches his daughter anything about the birds and the bees, or the fact that if you do slow dance with a guy who is also doing interpretive dance at a Christmas disco, that way pregnancy lies, Christine Baranski. But yeah, the fact that he sort of sorts it all out and gets rid of the baby, but also appears to give it away to somebody who lives about three doors down. This is strange to me.
It doesn't make a lot of sense. or at all. Really.
Well, one of the things I did want to ask about that was because when I was desperately trying to find somebody who I could pin the blame on for this astonishingly strange film, I kept coming back to Maria S. Schlatter, who wrote the screenplay, who appears to have no credits anywhere at all, and who, and this is the key thing, I think, wrote the stage production that this is drawn from. Because
I couldn't find any record of that ever being produced. No, admittedly, I only give it a quick Google.
But it probably hadn't been. But there are elements of this that I think do chime with the much, much, much better Netflix film Jingle Jangle, which again was also originally supposed to be a Broadway show. And that is very telling because that film is half an hour too long and involves lots of Broadway things that would work brilliantly on stage and don't necessarily so well on screen. But that's the thing. On stage, sometimes if you play things big enough, you can get away with having a backstory that is essentially scribbled on the back of an envelope, which this film very much is. But again, in a film, you need to somehow flesh that out a little bit. Or, as you say, stick the bits together with plasticine just to go, we'll give her one more friend or one more relative or just something to make this all sort of make sense.
Well, it's funny because I thought the baby plot was actually like profoundly moving, because I spent a lot of time this summer listening to Dolly Parton's America, the podcast, and they delve into a lot of her back catalogue, which I wasn't very familiar with. And actually a recurring theme in Dolly's early work and songwriting was women and what's done to women by men. And like one of her very early songs is a very dark one called The Bridge. And it's about a woman, a young woman who sleeps with somebody, she gets pregnant and she ends up throwing herself off a bridge. And like, there's a lot of stuff around women's like babies being taken away from them and women being persecuted because of their sexuality. So for me, this was like an actual theme in Dolly's work. And it's also something that like up until the early 80s, at least was genuinely happening in Ireland, that people's children are being taken away from them.
Yeah, true.
So that part of the story to me was the most compelling. And I actually got really upset when I was watching it. And that went some way to fleshing Christine Baranski's character out, albeit it was absolutely ludicrous how they did it. But then that's such an interesting plot, but it's wasted in this movie because it's then shoehorned into this Bible lamp thing. What I did like was because Dolly Parton's all about forgiveness, and that's what she always preaches. And I liked that this movie, Christine Baranski hates her dad so much because of what he did, which I 100% agree with. But Dolly Parton, the angel, tries to show the other side where she says, look, he thought it was the right thing for you. So albeit it's flawed what he did, he was coming at it from an ill-informed place of love. Yeah. And I kind of liked all that, but none of that actually made any sense in the context of her owning a town, kicking everyone out of the town. So yeah, I didn't really know what to make of it other than it did affect me. But I agree, it didn't really work in the movie.
I was really excited in the first 15 minutes when we'd had a really good dance routine. And then there was what looked like a sort of infertility / IVF storyline with the pastor and his wife. Although the poor wife is also sort of given this subplot where she feels like she's got no self-esteem and that she's letting him down, which to be fair is also a big trope in infertility, but is also just in this case, just an example of, you know, bad character development.
Yeah.
But again, like Kathy was saying, this storyline again was completely wasted because, spoiler, at the end, the angel points her Kira Snapchat filter hands at the wife's tummy and, you know, chimes and come. And then it's like, oh my God, that's how IVF works. Well done, everybody. Mm. But it is so odd because, as Kathy says quite rightly, like Dolly Parton has done incredible work both in her song and in her personal life to make, or if not to make life better for people, then to reflect the realities that many, 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 many people go through. And she did a brilliant episode of Brené Brown's podcast a couple of weeks ago, in which it became abundantly clear that her sort of real persona, if you like, is actually very quiet, very faith-driven, not necessarily sort of religious in the sort of, you know, going to church and dancing around in robes sort of thing, although, my God, go back and check out Joyful Noise from 2012. But it's very much about doing the good work and looking after the people in trouble. And there are sort of elements of that in this film, but then there's also a big scene in the church when all these God-fearing folk run around inside the church saying how awful Christine Baranski's character is and how she deserves to be burnt alive for a witch. And I was like, oh, okay, I don't think I've seen this in any of the Southern films, but yes.
Yeah, it's weird that, isn't it? Because, right, so, I mean, that's a catchier song, although I had kind of no idea what they meant by the Wicked Witch of the Middle, and it took me quite a long time to figure out, okay, it's like it's a contrast to the Witch of the East and the Witch of the West. There's also a Witch of the Middle. I guess, kind of, I mean, it would maybe help if you'd built up more of a Wizard of Oz thing before doing that, but yeah, okay, fine. But I think it was weird because I feel like Debbie Allen, the director, does a disservice to Debbie Allen, the choreographer, in that and other scenes, because it's very hard to have a lot of choreography going in when everyone's sitting in pews, which they are for two big dance routines in this film, which is bizarre. And then even the opening dance number where they're in the square, I just felt like it was shot quite badly. I thought the dancing was good, although there were weird like Christmas trees popping up out of nowhere, which I didn't really understand. But like the dancing is really impressive, but like it would be framed slightly off to one side or just slightly, you know, happening in the background where something non-interesting was happening in the foreground. It was a little bit bizarre to me, but I mean, you know, it's a weird film. But then we haven't even talked about the angels yet, because of course we open the film with Dolly Parton in quote unquote homeless mode. She's wearing sort of a grey fur and a perfect smoky eye and begging for change, which I think might have a double meaning, you see.
You know, well, very clever. Those
eyelashes are doing double time because they basically act as extended hands. I mean, yeah, she could really probably carry several pounds worth of money in those eyelashes. It's just amazing.
She is incredible. But she does turn out to be Baranski's guardian angel and comes to her while she's going through potential brain tumor fears. This is all connecting back to Last Holiday, Kat, if you think about it. It's once again, there's a shadow on the MRI. Oh my goodness, does she have terminal brain cancer?
Or do they need to clean the machine?
Or do they just need to clean the machine? It does give Christine Baranski one of the very good lines in the film. There are not very many, but she really delivers. I knew that brain tumors were deadly. I had no idea they were so obnoxious, because she thinks that Dolly might be a symptom, a sort of hallucination produced by this, which in fairness, that does actually seem plausible.
This yeah, like true. She's sitting on a cloud in her living room.
Also really enjoying Christine Baranski's doctor telling her off for driving erratically when she appears to be driving at 1 mile an hour.
Around the tiny square.
Exactly.
Not a big set. No, not a very big set.
And also, Christine Baranski supposedly came from the big city and like arrived that morning. Why is she getting medical advice from like the town GP of this? Like, presumably she's evicting him as well. So it just all doesn't add up, any of it. It's ridiculous. It's like the more you dive into the plot, the more it unravels.
You're saying we should probably just skim the surface, maybe.
Well, and let's not forget, of course, that her personal assistant, who was so badly drawn that I can't even remember what her name was, who then turns out to be a trainee angel a la Clarence from It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and literally they reference Clarence, and literally there's another line somewhere, I think it's sung, where she says, your life isn't wonderful and you're not George Bailey.
Yeah.
So they're really tying it in, like specifically Clarence is basically Dolly's boss in this, mm-hmm. right?
He's kind of the senior angel.
She says something about, I'll tell Clarence.
That's so bad. It's like when you're trying to reference other movies within your movie because you know you don't hold up on your own. Like, it's just embarrassing.
Yeah. Although the irony that they just at no time sort of really seem to reference Scrooge or Scrooge-like behaviour when she is just like the absolute cast iron example of Scrooge-like behaviour.
We did have a Tiny Tim. We had the little girl.
Of course.
That's true.
It's almost
like
maybe...
with bizarre amounts of blood all over her dad's arms, which didn't feel suited to a U-rated Christmas film. But there we go.
Can I quickly tell you guys what I thought the movie was going to do with that little girl?
Yeah,
and
please.
It was way better than what happened. So I thought when we found out Christine Baranski had a kid and we're like trying to put together who could it be? I was like, it has to be either Pastor Christian or his wife because they're the only two people we know. Or I think it's going to be that little girl's mom.
Oh.
And then Christine Baranski realizes that she, by virtue of evicting a pharmacist who's 3 days behind on his rent, killed her own daughter while she was trying to save her daughter. Christine Baranski would have to live with that forever, that she murdered her own daughter. And then that young child would have to forgive her, and it would have been really profound. And then I was so excited for this to happen. And then no, it was Pastor Christian all along.
I love that idea. That is so
that
much better.
That was better, right?
Right. Not least because the timelines and the age would work out so much better. Because how old is
and
this
also
pastor?
It would have meant something where Pastor Christian meant nothing. Like yesterday you're talking about burning her on a griddle and now you're happy she's your mother.
Yeah, and suddenly everybody's like, oh, thank God it's Regina, who we definitely don't hate and definitely didn't sing around the church on Christmas Eve wishing we could burn her alive.
That makes perfect sense. I mean, let's talk about the little girl. I think it was Violet. The car accident, I had real problems with this. This tripped up my sister and she literally just couldn't stop laughing because they had this car accident when they're on their way to the cemetery so she could leave flowers on her mother's grave like we do every Christmas. That's definitely the amount of explanation you give people in those circumstances for a start. But also the dad emerges from the car accident and he's just got one sleeve of his t-shirt slit open. And that's like, I don't understand how that literally happens in a car accident. He's just got like one rip on his shoulder in a way that makes no sense to me. But I'm sure there's a really
profound
reason.
It happens if you're
reason.
That good looking and you're that muscular. You need to show off. He's the best actor in the movie. He's the best singer in the movie. Like, they needed him to have this moment in the bed, which he did, which was incredible. But also I was like, really dark of Dolly the angel. She seemed to have engineered that this child would be in a car crash just to teach Christine Baranski a lesson. That was really dark.
But that was pretty terrifying.
I do also, I like this sort of mental image that I have of Debbie Allen, who again was in and directed Grey's Anatomy for several episodes, sort of putting her hand up and going, guys, I've learned some stuff from that series and I'm going to step aside, Debbie Allen. We want this guy to show off at least one bicep. There will be blood. There will be so much blood, even though we're not quite sure where it comes from. But there will be blood.
And we're not quite sure what her injury was, because it's dangerous enough to be life-threatening, but not dangerous enough that she's out of hospital 5 minutes after completing treatment for it. So it's a very, very specific kind of injury that the poor little Violet has suffered.
But did Dolly cure the girl with her sparkles, or did the pediatric neurosurgeon that they flew in cure her? Because that wasn't clear to me.
I think that was one for science.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
But I vast loads of cash.
Yeah, but I think that Dolly's inspired maybe Regina to bring in the neuro pediatrician, whatever, right. p- I don't know what they're called. That. Again, we may be overthinking. We're certainly giving this film more thought than anyone involved seems to have done. And we haven't even mentioned Treat Williams, Regina's love interest in the most undercooked love story I think I've seen in any of these films.
And again, to go back to these, I mean, inexplicably awful costumes, but in his sort of like big number at the beginning, when he's in his general store that, far from actually being a general store, seems to purely exist to sell like tatty ice skates from circa 1934 and old sleighs, this entire general store, which presumably is not like Christmas themed, is basically painted red, which clashes horribly with this absolutely revolting burgundy plaid shirt that he's got on, which he later trades for an equally disgusting tweed blazer. But again, singing like Treat Williams, did you not go on a date since you left high school? Why are you still thinking about your true love when she's obviously turned into an absolute rampaging monster who again is evicting the entire town, including you? Get some self-esteem.
Yeah, and he just has that one line in the big final song where he goes, "I'll be a grandpa if I have my way," and you're like, I'm sorry, where did that come from?
And like, you were together 40 years ago, and from what we can derive from this plot, you didn't even have sex, and you're still hung up on her. Like, it's utterly bizarre. Like, they're too old to be framing a high school prom as the last time either of them felt love.
Yes.
Just didn't work for me.
And especially given that, like, the pastor is how old? Is he supposed to be 25, 30, 40? Because, I mean, Treat Williams and Christine Baranski are significantly older than is sort of believable.
Oh, yeah, good point.
For her having had kid.
Okay, let's be charitable. Let's see, he's 35. 35 plus 18 would mean they're both 53.
Lol.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, that's not quite right, is it? Yeah.
Her wig is not playing that hard. And yeah.
Okay, so let's wrap this up a little bit, because I do want to talk about It's a Wonderful Life as well. So, rating this film on its Christmassiness, like, where do you think it scores there? Out of, let's say, 5, score for Christmassiness.
I don't think it's very Christmassy, because even though it's set at Christmas, it doesn't have a lot of, like, it doesn't visually really look like Christmas. It doesn't have Christmas music in it because it's original music. And it yes, it has themes of forgiveness and immaculate conception.
yes.
Angel.
Yeah, maybe give it a 2 or 3 out of 5.
All right. Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, I need more Christmas spirit from mine, and I just can't get over the congregation being such absolute monsters. although that said, in terms of something else I do want from my Christmas films is good reaction gifts. And there is one moment right towards the end of the film when Regina is introduced by the pastor. She is obviously now completely reformed and therefore wearing a white dress. And this guy on the right hand side of the church wearing a red and white striped jumper turns around with such a ridiculous expression that I actually got my friend to stop watching it so that I could rewind it 6 times and then film it, try and turn it into a GIF, because that is extraordinary. So I'm afraid on Christmassiness, this only gets like at most 2, and that's but it's just horrible.
Yeah. I might. Yeah, no, you're right. It's not even a 3. I think it's going to be a 2 from me as well. I didn't hate the music. I thought Everybody Needs an Angel was actually kind of a banger. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of great lyrics. I think Dolly at her best is one of the best lyricists out there. You know, there's a line about, I think it's angels fly because they take themselves lightly. That's a lovely line.
Beautiful.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So she has like really, really beautiful bits in it. But yeah, overall, I don't think it's her best work musically. I think I know the answer to this one. Objective quality. How would we rate this film?
Well, we haven't even discussed the Scottish parable of the lamplighter, Helen.
And oh, so I forgot.
On the sheer, I don't know what the hell is going on, because there are no Scottish parables in the Bible. Then purely on that, obviously, I have to give it a 1.
Yes, it would have scored higher, but then it mentioned Scotland. So.
I think objective, if I take away my love of Dolly, it would be a 1 on quality. I mean, it's cheap as chips, this movie. I think they spent all the money just paying Dolly.
Mm.
And her costume designer.
Yes, for the rhinestones.
The orphans need to stitch those rhinestones on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I did enjoy Christine Baranski's continual contempt for rhinestones. She's wrong, for the record. My wardrobe has a lot of rhinestones. I love them. but it was at least funny that she kept kind of poking Dolly that way. That was good.
This is true. I do just wish somebody had paid like $500 for somebody to come in and just ensure that everybody was wearing makeup that actually suited their colouring and like warm shoes. Mm.
But I think, Helen, if you did an enjoyment scale, I'd be 4 out of 5 for sure.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I enjoyed it, but I think I was laughing at, not with, a lot of the time. So, yeah. Let's talk then about It's a Wonderful Life, because I feel like, well, what's interesting to me, okay, and I said this on Twitter, but I'm going to repeat myself. What's interesting to me about Christmas on the Square is that it seems to be going for all of the Christmas movie tropes at once. It's got the Scrooge, Christmas Carol kind of redo thing, which a lot of them do. It's got the business person moving to a small town and rediscovering the value of rediscovering what's important in life thing. And it also kind of has or tries to have the, again, person moving to a small town and falling in love with somebody wearing a lot of plaid. so it kind of tries to do all of those, but it also adds in the angel element. And this is a rarer Christmas movie trope, and it pretty much all comes from It's a Wonderful Life, it seems to me, which is the kind of granddaddy of the genre. And I didn't realize when asking you both to compare these two movies that, Kat, you didn't like It's a Wonderful Life.
So I had my own Christmas joyful epiphany, for which I must thank you, Dolly Parton / Helen O'Hara, which is that I had always had in me the knowledge that I absolutely loathed It's a Wonderful Life because I thought it was one of the most deeply upsetting, cruel, miserable things that I'd ever seen. And rather crucially, whilst watching it this time, I realised this was because in my teenage years, I had only seen the last half of It's a Wonderful Life. I had not seen the entire film, which is which explains quite a lot. Mm. But also, my God, this is a long film. My husband and I split it over a couple of nights, and that worked very well for us. But I'm delighted to say that I have completely revisited my loathing of It's a Wonderful Life, because that fairly crucial opening sort of hour and a half in which we learn about George Bailey and him actually being a nice person and not just living in a miserable place with a horrible life is fairly crucial. And also, you know, so I mean, arguably Christmas on the Square is sort of like only having that last half of It's a Wonderful Life, because we never see anything remotely redeemable about Christine Baranski.
Yeah, she's kind of the Mr. Potter role rather than the George Bailey role. And that's kind of a crucial difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. How about you, Kathy? Are you a fan? Is it one of your ones on rotation?
I actually only saw it for the first time. I had to research back in my own podcast to figure out when it was. it was 2016.
Oh, wow.
I had never seen it. And turns out neither had my husband. And it was on in the Rio Cinema in Dalston. And at the time, I realised why I hadn't seen it was I kind of wasn't sure if I liked it either, because I had seen it parodied so much. And I'd seen the ending just like you, Kat. So I kept, okay, I've seen The Simpsons doing it. I've seen movies taking the piss out of it. I've seen the ending, so I know what happened. So exactly like you, I was particularly uninterested in it. Went and sat in the cinema, which was a lovely way to watch it, because as you say, it's a very long movie. And it was like this, it was like the week before Christmas, and it was just the best way to see it. So I recommend if you ever have it in a cinema, go and see it in the cinema. And yeah, I loved it as well. But crucially, because the first half, we see everything that George has done to help people, and he's really... At the end of the movie, it's truly believable that if he hadn't lived, like, you know, the town could have been awful. Mm. Whereas in this movie, in Christmas in the Square, of Christine Baranski, it's awful. But if she hadn't been there, the only difference is that we wouldn't have Pastor Christian, which is no bad thing. So, yeah, I'm a really big fan of It's a Wonderful Life. I think it's such a deserved classic. It's wonderful. It's incomparable in terms of quality and resonance to Christmas on the Square.
Absolutely. And the clothes, oh God.
Oh my God.
I just slavered over all of them. It's so funny, actually, Kathy, that you talk about the parodies, because as we saw the sign for Bedford Falls, I just got flashbacks to episodes and book adaptations of Red Dwarf, where Lister goes and lives in Bedford Falls for a while. And again, because my only knowledge of it was from that last hour, I was like, Lister, you moron, why are you going to live in that miserable place? But the other thing was, again, because I'm very, very fond, as I think you are, Helen, of Little Shop of Horrors. And of course, there's that song Somewhere That's Green, in which she sings about, and I'd look like Donna Reed. Mm. And Donna Reed, of course, plays
Mary.
What's her name? Mary Bailey, that's it, in this. Beautiful, absolutely gorgeous, but also crucially, she has a personality and a character and interest, which arguably nobody in Christmas on the Square has got.
that's kind of sadly true. I mean, yeah, she's actually pretty cool. Like, she, first of all, she decides she's going to marry George Bailey at the age of 8, approximately, sticks to that, but along the way also goes to college, you know, learns how to rebuild old houses. She's basically one of those Instagram accounts we all follow of sort of somebody fixing up a beaten down old house, and is incredibly active in the town as well. It's sort of, I think the thing about It's a Wonderful Life, like, it's really interesting in terms of, like, coming out straight after World War II, being all about this kind of communal spirit, this kind of working together, you know, sacrificing for the greater good, all these kind of really traditional values, but they're done kind of lightly. There's enough kind of humor in it and enough kind of heart in it that you don't feel it's too preachy. Well, apparently audiences at the time didn't. It didn't actually do that well at the time, but now it just feels kind of warm and cozy and encouraging in that stuff.
I think, yes, once we get to the end, but I think one of the things I found most difficult to watch were all the scenes in which George ends up having to spend money on trying to appease members of the town.
Yeah.
And I think you've absolutely hit the nail on the head there, that it is very much about community spirit, but that two people or one person cannot run the community. Mm. The whole community needs to dig in and help. So it can't just be, you know, George Bailey and his wife building houses for the town or using their honeymoon fund to sort of stop their bank going bust. Mm. It does need that investment from all those people. And actually, as I watched him standing by the Christmas tree, holding his kid, just looking in sort of disbelief, but also just looking so relieved, because he was like, obviously through this film, we've seen how much he's sacrificed to sort of keep other people's projects and other people's legacies going. And this time I sort of looked at his face and I saw that as him going, okay, now is when I get my legacy. Mm. And when his brother was like, you are the richest man in town, there was about bloody time, because God knows I've done enough to sort of keep Bedford Falls going and people should, you know, flipping well pay me back.
No, this
sort
is it.
In a more charitable Christmassy way.
See, the reason I never realized that you hadn't seen the first half when we've talked about this film in the past is when you said the first half is depressing, I kind of agree with you, because, you know, him giving up one dream after another, he gives up his trip to Europe and then he gives up his college and then he gives up his honeymoon, and like, it's one thing after another, and that is really, really upsetting. I mean, there's lots of fun and loveliness and great people in that first hour or so as well, but it is really, really a series of these huge sacrifices. So I just figured, yeah, I mean, that's fair. It is a lot of sacrificing. I can see why Kat finds it really depressing. It never occurred to me you just hadn't seen that bit.
But I think the thing actually from watching it this time was that the real difference is in George Bailey's mindset. Mm. Because yes, he does make these decisions, but he makes these decisions. He could still have gone off on his holiday. He could still have just gone, you know what, I'm going to college. But he decides that he's going to do this and then he throws himself into it full pelt. It is just that when it gets to the sort of, you know, middle of the film, he's run out of gas. He's beyond running on empty. Yeah. And then losing that $8,000 and going, God, that was my idiot uncle that lost it. What a moron. I'm keeping everything running. I think that will probably be a sentiment that's very familiar to a lot of people during lockdown as well. It's just, you know, you can keep cheerful, you can be resilient and everything, but after a while, if you don't get a win, that is when you start really just going, what is the bloody point? Who is having a laugh? What the hell is happening? And even the jolliest soul will just be like, I just give up. No. And I think that's done really effectively with George.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's like almost like a big metaphor for 2020 when you rewatch it now. Because we've all, like, you talk about all the things George gave up. And like, you know, in 2020, the amount of things any one person will have given up this year. Like, one of the things I've found really odd about 2020 is like the absence of something to look forward to, whatever that may be for you, whether it's seeing your family. It might be a wedding that somebody cancelled. It might be a holiday. It might be whatever it is. And they're the trivial things, because I know people have been ill and it's been much worse for people. But like watching that, you can really like, I felt more than ever I could actually picture myself in George Bailey's shoes this time around watching it. And like, I'm a really naturally optimistic person. And sometimes this year I've just been like, fuck, I can't talk to somebody today, because if they're depressed, I have nothing to give them. I'll only take, this will not be a good conversation. And I really empathize with George this time watching it more than I did the first time.
I 100% agree. It is such a 2020 film. I mean, it just this, and again, this sense of all being in it together. And sometimes the frustration that has, you know, it's like, well, I'm wearing my mask and I'm staying home. And why the hell is that dude going out and doing whatever he's doing? Mm-hmm. You know, there is that kind of sense of you're trying to do your best. You're trying to do as much as you can. And still things are not going right. And sometimes you're just like, oh, my God.
And then imagine an uncle bankrupted us at the end of it. He's so pissed.
The only thing about the scenes with his uncle is I now can't get the John Mulaney routine about that out of my head. If you guys have seen Kid Gorgeous, also on Netflix, he does a little bit about George Bailey basically swearing at his uncle. So now all I can hear is John Mulaney's voice in my head during that scene, just going, "Where's the money? Where's the money, you old fuck?" and sort of slapping him around, which of course George Bailey doesn't do, because he, you know, didn't swear because production code was in force at the time. But you know, it's still now in my head, and that's
but
that's
when he me. Lost it at his kid and he like really shouts at his kid.
Yeah,
I'm like I was locked down with two kids this year, you know. There was times when I was not proud of how I parented, and a lot of people have been in that situation. Like, I had a newborn baby, I had a toddler,
god,
we're in a house all day together. And my toddler's watched a lot more TV than I ever thought a toddler should watch this year. And, you know, like, I've not been the best mother. And, like, honestly, you can really feel it. And I think it's there's a resonance. And it's funny, you talk about it after, it was after World War II. Mm. And we've all been through what our wartime conditions this year, fiscally and physically and lots of other reasons. And, I find it very profound. It's why this movie's a classic. And it's why Christmas on the Square probably won't be a classic.
It depends how many wines you've had, I think, Christmas on the Square. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, enough. I actually would watch it again, for the record. I would watch Christmas on the Square again, for sure. But this movie is something special. There's a reason everyone bows down to it.
Yeah. This is our family Christmas Eve movie. This is like, Christmas has officially started when we watch this.
Oh, that's so nice.
Good.
Yeah.
Every year.
Pretty much every year. Yeah. It'll be on.
And it's so long. You can eat so many Terry's chocolate oranges during it as well.
Which is key. That is a key metric of Christmas movie success. You're so right.
Yeah. And mince pies for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Something I really valued about this film, going back to our conversation about production values, amazing use of snow throughout, both as sort of like underlining, as you know, painting Bedford Falls is really beautiful, but then also something that if you just put the right sound effect in is actually really threatening and horrible. And we particularly see that, I think, when he's walking back through Potterville. And I suppose looking at it now through 2020's eyes, you're like, oh, a dime a dance? Well, that sounds quite lovely and everything. But it is just the sense of menace that goes through it. And then him sort of, you know, reaching his taxi driver friend and being so relieved. And then the taxi driver just basically treating him like any other insane drunk and taking him to the house and everything. And it's just, yeah, it's just, I think, just so, so beautifully done, basically just by just changing that mood ever so slightly. It's so subtle and it is so effective.
It's so true. I would like to point out at this point, at my sister's behest, she is a librarian. She would like me to say that it is not the case that the worst thing an unmarried woman can be is a librarian in her 30s. And that particular element of Potterville is perhaps unfair to librarians.
Yeah, and that is the bit of the movie that annoyed me, because she, as we said, she's such an accomplished woman. Like, she's incredible. Whether or not she met George Bailey, I think she would have been just fine. I think George Bailey, if he hadn't met her, wouldn't have been fine.
Amen.
But there's a scene about very earlier on in the movie when we kind of, they're at this dance together and kind of like encapsulates their attitude, their early attitude to life, where like somebody messes with the floor and they fall into the swimming pool, and instead of admitting defeat, they like continue to dance really joyously in the swimming pool. And I'm like, that's George. That's like me in January of this year. I would have been dancing in the swimming pool. Me in December of this year, I would have been like, fuck it, I'm out of here. And I just really love that George and Mary in that scene, I think that like captures them as a couple and like the joy they have for life. And for some reason I like got really upset watching that scene. I just found it so touching that that's how positive they were, and to know what the years are going to do to him. And like, I just, every scene means something in this movie, even something that looks silly like that at the beginning and looks like it's just for a bit of a spectacle on screen.
Yeah,
it's really meaningful.
It's also a really well juggled ensemble cast. I feel like it, you know, everybody has a little bit to do. I mean, Bert and Ernie and the Muppets are named after this Bert and Ernie, and they're barely bit parts, but they make enough of an impact, you know, to become Muppets. I mean, there's no higher praise.
They depict friendship really, really well in this film. And again, I think the thing that is really emotional about George and Mary is that they are, if not necessarily soulmates, they are just really, really good friends who have a lovely time together. And I quite like that Mary is a spinster in the Potterville version, because it suggests that everybody in the Potterville version is such an asshat that she wouldn't deign to marry any of them, which seemed remarkably sensible. But I think that also made me quite emotional, because, you know, we haven't really seen that much of our soulmates and best friends and that sort of thing this year at all. And yeah, you can chat on WhatsApp and everything, but it's just that odd thing of going through so, so many months without having that sort of shorthand that comes from seeing the people that really matter to you.
Yeah.
Except on screen, Helen.
All right, we're all going to have a group hug after this is over, but let's wrap it up. So for this one, Christmassiness, score out of 5, please.
5. I mean, it's 5. It's unquestionably a 5. It ends on Auld Lang Syne around a Christmas tree.
Yeah, it's hard to argue with that. Yeah. I would go 5. How about you, Kat?
I would say between 3 and 4, because obviously loads of it is not set at Christmas, but I'm sure somebody could do a YouTube cut like the Julia cut of Julie and Julia.
Amen. And objective quality?
5. It's a 5-star for me.
4 for me, because it's far too long. And I just need a shorter film. But that's literally me. And I have ADHD and I will use that as an excuse.
Well, normally I hate long movies, but it's funny. This one, Well, A, because I saw it in the cinema, which helps, but B, because I felt like you really pay off the first hour and a half at the end. For me, once, the length is justified.
I agree with that, because I think that's the thing, isn't it? A lot of the parodies that you see, you just see the end and it's cloying and it's over the top and it's too much. Whereas in It's a Wonderful Life itself, they absolutely earn that ending with all of this self-sacrifice, all of this trauma, all of this despair. You know, you need that much. It's like portals, okay? Because everything comes back to Avengers. It's like you earn the moment where all the heroes turn up because you've killed off half the universe beforehand. So it kind of, you know.
That's the thing. And I think this worked better for me thinking about it almost like a TV series. And I've basically just had to stop watching His Dark Materials because I'm so furious and annoyed and frustrated by all the extra random old tat that they've put in it to pad it out. But actually, every single extra bit that is in It's a Wonderful Life completely earns its place. And as you say, that payoff at the end, even though you do kind of want to go and shout at every townsfolk person and go, stop randomly taking out $200, for God's sake.
242.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's not a bank. Like, it's some sort of co-optive credit union scenario where people just get money.
Exactly. And that one guy, with his $242. Oh, whereas her with $1,750, I was here for.
Yeah, fair enough.
Anyway, that might be a little bit of a deep dive there, which will only make sense to people who've seen it about 64 times. Well, listen, that about wraps it up. I think we have a clear winner this year. But again, if you have had enough wines, you may very much enjoy Christmas on the Square, and we still love Dolly. So thank you, Kathy, for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me, and lovely to meet you, Kat.
And thanks to Kat as well.
Merry Christmas, Kathy and Helen. What an absolute joy. Well, half of it.
And do please rejoin us for the next one for more Christmas fun next time on Bah Humbug. Ho, ho, happy Christmas.
Oh, oh my God.
I'm still working on the outro. I don't know. If you've enjoyed listening to Bah Humbug, please give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts because it really helps other people find the show. You can also subscribe so you automatically get the rest of this podcast lined up hassle-free, and it's only going to be a limited run up to Christmas. It won't be using up all your data. If you'd like to hear more from me, you can pre-order my book, Women vs. Hollywood, The Fall and Rise of Women in Film, which comes out in February 2021. You can also, of course, find me in Empire Magazine, which is the world's best film magazine for my money. And I'm on the Empire podcast every week and host the podcast His Darker Materials to coincide with BBC HBO drama His Dark Materials. If you'd like to connect with me or comment on the show or have any queries or comments, I'd love to hear from you. You can find me on Twitter at Helen L. O'Hara, or you can email producers@stripped.media. And I'd like to thank all the people who have made this podcast happen. Thanks to all the team at Stripped Media, including Ben Williams, who edits this podcast, as well as Tom Wally, Dave Corkery, and Kobe Omanaka, who have all helped produce and put this show together. Thanks also to all of my guests who have been absolutely wonderful in giving up their time to watch some Christmas films that are not always 100% great. If you'd like to know more about this podcast and others produced by Stripped Media, please visit www.stripped.media to find out more. And that's it. Merry Christmas. You just heard a Stripped Media production.